Okay, I think we can start then. So I'd like to welcome everyone back to this 8 session program on shamatha practice, focusing on mindfulness of breathing as the main focus. We're in session 6 now, we're going to start to focus at the entrance and nostrils in this session today. But before we begin, let's start by setting good motivation. So once again, we can do that in our own way. And in setting motivation, it's always helpful to try and include others in our motivation, not just having a motivation for our own benefit, but also so that we can be of more benefit to those around us. So let's have a look at what we'll be covering in this evening's session. So session 6 again, focusing on the mindfulness of breathing practice in terms of focusing at the entrance of the nostrils. As always, we'll start with a review of some of the earlier topics, and then we'll continue with the mindfulness of breathing practice that we were doing last session, that is focusing in the area of the abdomen. And then in terms of the main topic for this session, we'll continue on the stages of progress that we looked at in the last 2 sessions. We've gone through the 9 stages of progress to shamatha now. And so here this evening, we'll be looking at the process of actually achieving shamatha, and then what is beyond shamatha. And then we'll be looking at the main practice for this evening, and that'll be the mindfulness of breathing, focusing at the entrance of the nostrils. And as normal, a Q&A at the end. So as we go through the session, if you have any questions, you can put that in the chat for the end of it, for later in the session. So we saw that the recommended reading for this program is Attention Revolution from Alan Wallace. I'll be quoting from that a couple of times this evening, and also from this Lamrim Chenmo, the great treatise on the stages of the path to enlightenment from Lama Tsong Kapa. A lot of technical information there if you're interested in more detailed information. And we'll be also quoting a little bit from Lamrim Chenmo in this evening's session. And in the shamatha training, the first point is the prerequisites, which is all about how to set up our life to support such shamatha training. And that'll be the main topic for the next session for next Tuesday. And then in terms of the actual shamatha practice, we looked at the how to prepare body, speech, and mind at the beginning of a meditation session. We looked at that in session 1. And then in the actual shamatha practice, we looked at what qualities are we cultivating, what objects should we focus on, what are the tools we use, and what sorts of faults can arise and how to overcome them. And then in the last session, so that'll be next Thursday, we'll be looking at how to integrate this practice into daily life. And in terms of stages of progress, as I mentioned, we've covered the 9 stages to shamatha in the last 2 sessions, and we'll move on to the achieving shamatha and beyond shamatha in this session. But first, there's a couple of points I want to look at or review regarding first qualities. And so we can begin with a quote here from the Lamrim Chenmo from Tsongkhapa. He says, "The concentration that you will accomplish here has 2 special features, vivid intensity, i.e. an intense mental clarity, and a non-discursive stability, staying one-pointedly on the object of meditation." So as we mentioned earlier in this program, in the classic meditation texts, such as this one here, Lamrim Chenmo, 2 qualities are normally mentioned, the stability and clarity, to be able to focus single-pointedly and in a very clear way. And here, and we added, of course, relaxation for us in the modern world. But also here, Tsongkhapa says that some add bliss to these, making 3 features. So then we often have a presentation of 3 qualities that we start to, of the mind, that we start to really experience the more we go into this shamatha practice. So again, the clarity, which we already mentioned. And as we go into the higher levels of shamatha practice and have more this stability of attention, meaning that the mind starts to calm down and we're more focusing on the object, then we start to experience this sense of non-conceptuality, that the conceptual discursive mind calms down. And we sort of have this experience of non-conceptuality. And then the third quality, as Tsongkhapa mentioned, was bliss. And so the meditation texts here on shamatha, when these three qualities are described, and we really fully achieve these qualities when we achieve shamatha, there's a lot of warnings that come together with these three qualities. And one warning is to avoid getting caught up in craving and attachment for them, because each one of these three qualities is very nice. It's very nice to have a clear mind, a still mind, and a very blissful mind. So when these three qualities start to manifest as we get into this shamatha practice, then people go, oh, this is really nice. I like this. I want this. And so we end up with craving and attachment to these qualities. And then, of course, that craving and attachment means these qualities would immediately disappear. And then people go, oh, I really like that. Let's try and recreate that bliss. Let's try and recreate that stillness of mind. And of course, with craving and attachment, that's impossible. And so then people just get more and more frustrated. So rather than getting caught up in these three qualities with craving and attachment, see them simply as signposts that our meditation is going in the right direction. And then use these very experiences to go deeper into the practice. Another warning that sometimes comes up is to avoid getting caught up in fear. Now, the reason that we often get caught up in fear in this shamatha practice is that our normal sense of identity is often, what's the word I'm looking for? It's often reinforced, constantly reinforced by two things. First, this solid sense of body, me, me, me. So we identify with this body as me. And then also, we identify with a lot of mental content, our thoughts, emotions, memories, all of these things that are constantly going on in the mind reinforce a sense of me. When we go into this shamatha practice, and particularly when the mind starts to become still and quiet, what you will notice is first, often the solid sense of body can drop away because we're focusing on the mental sphere. So we can have no sense of body. Also, when the mind goes quiet, there's no mental activity going on, then there's nothing reinforcing a sense of me mentally. So there's the two things which normally are constantly reinforcing a sense of me suddenly have dropped away. And then often we end up with a lot of fear because we wrongly interpret that experience as I'm going out of existence. And so a lot of fear arises. And so Alan Wallace, in his Attention Revolution, he addresses this point. So I'd like to read what he says on page 100 of Attention Revolution. He says, one of the more common challenges in this practice is the emergence of fear. As you release your grip on the contents of your mind, you are undermining your normal sense of personal identity, which is constantly reinforced by thinking, by recalling, and identifying with your personal history, hopes, and plans. Now you are disengaging from these familiar supports for substantiating your ego. As lapses between thoughts occur more and more frequently and for longer periods, your awareness hovers in a kind of empty space, a vacuum devoid of personhood. So this is this experience of non-conceptuality or stillness that we see here. He goes on to say, you may come into the grip of fear as your normal sense of who you are loses its footing. The teacher Genlam Rinpa warned his students that such dread may well arise during their training. It is crucial, he counseled, not to identify with it nor give it any credence. Some kinds of fear are based in reality. They protect us from danger, filling the body with energy so that we can flee or protect ourselves in whatever way necessary. But this kind of dread with no clear object has no such basis in reality. There is no danger in the empty luminous space of awareness. You have nothing to lose but your false sense of an independent controlling ego. The only thing being threatened is an illusion. If you don't identify with it, there's nothing to fear. If you do identify with this fear, it may bring your entire practice to a grinding halt and throw you into deep emotional imbalances. So it is of utmost importance to observe such fear without distraction and without grasping. Keep to the essentials of the practice. So therefore, this, again, if fear arises, it's usually for this reason, and it's irrational fear. The only thing that is going out of existence is a false sense of me. Actually, a false sense of me that is the root cause of all of our mental afflictions and suffering. And if you're having this fear arise because you feel like there's no sense of me anymore, and you feel like I don't exist or I'm going out of existence, you can simply ask the question, who's having the fear? Because if fear is arising, then definitely there's a me. There can be no fear without an agent. So the fact that fear is arising proves you exist. So there's nothing to fear. And then another warning with these experiences is avoid misinterpreting them. One is that once we start to get these experiences of clarity, of bliss and stillness or non-conceptuality, people often completely overestimate the level of progress. We saw that earlier when we were looking at particularly at stages, say even 3 and 4 and 5, you know, that it's quite common even at these relatively early stages to think, oh, I'm nearly at shamatha, you know, I can focus on the object and very well and all that. So it's very easy to overestimate level of progress. But also particularly this experience of non-conceptuality of stillness, it's very easy to misinterpret it as an insight into emptiness. Because what qualities arise when we realize emptiness? Clarity, non-conceptuality, and bliss. Exactly the same three qualities. But of course here, when we have this experience of non-conceptuality, this is not a realization of emptiness. We're not realizing anything. All that's happened is our mind has become still. So to avoid thinking we've realized some high level of nature of reality, when in fact we haven't. So that's in terms of the qualities. And then for the objects, we saw what object should we use in this practice? And the general recommendation is use the object that works best for you. And so we're using the breath because for many of us in the modern world, because we have a highly discursive mind, as we saw from the great Indian masters of the past and Tsongkhapa as well, recommending that we should meditate on the breath. And so we're looking at that in this program and these three variations. The full body, which is good for relaxation, the abdomen, good for stability, and starting in this session, focusing at the nostrils, very good for improving clarity of attention. But also Alan Wallace mentioned two other objects that were particularly suitable and relevant for us in the modern world, that is observing the thoughts or observing our mind and resting in awareness. And we also saw that particularly in the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, often is recommended to use a mental image of a Buddha. And here another quote from Lamrim Chenmo, which I think was came up in a question in an earlier session. Tsongkhapa says, concentration is not achieved in the sensory consciousnesses, but in the mental consciousness. Thus, the actual object of meditation of a concentration is the actual object of a mental consciousness. Therefore, you must keep your attention on this. So he's basically saying we have to have a mental object to achieve shamatha, that we cannot achieve shamatha based on a sense object. But then you ask, and this is the question that I think that came up earlier session, well, the breath is a sense object. So isn't this contradictory then? Why are we using the breath if we have to have a mental object to achieve shamatha? And the answer comes in Attention Revolution from Alan Wallace. He says, in the phases of mindfulness of breathing thus far, you have been attending in various ways to the tactile sensations of the respiration. However, to continue all the way along the path of shamatha, Eventually, you must shift your attention from the tactile sensations of breathing to what's called an acquired sign, a symbol of the air element that appears before your mind's eye as you progress in shamatha practice. So what we find is that actually, and let's say we're using the breath as the object, the sensations of the breath, once we start to get through to those middling stages of the nine stages, and as our attention improves, what happens is our sense faculties start to shut down. And at the higher stages of the shamatha path, the sense faculties completely shut down and go dormant. And so therefore we won't be able to focus on the tactile sensations because that's using the sense faculty. But here, what he's saying is that before that happens, due to focusing on the breath, what happens is spontaneously, what happens is a mental image called the acquired sign, which is relating to the air element, relating to the breath, spontaneously appears in your mind, a mental image. And then when that appears, you switch to that as your object and use that all the way to shamatha. And so there's three stages we go through. There's the preliminary sign, which is focusing on the actual tactile sensations of the breath. And then when this acquired sign arises, this mental image relating to the breath arises, use that the rest of the way to shamatha. When we achieve shamatha, that acquired sign becomes the what's called the counterpart sign, which is a really a subtle emblematic representation of the whole quality of the air element. And to describe these two, acquired sign and counterpart sign, we'll read from Alan Wallace's Attention Revolution. And so first, the acquired sign he talks about on page 63. So let's have a look at that. He says, to different people, acquired signs associated in breath practice may appear like a star, a cluster of gems or pearls, a wreath of flowers, a puff of smoke, a cobweb, a cloud, a lotus flower, a wheel, or the moon or sun. Meaning that what the mental image looks like will be completely different for different people, depending on the physiology and so forth, the disposition of the person. He says, the various appearances of the acquired sign are related to the mental dispositions of individual meditators. If you wish to continue on the path of mindfulness of breathing, which here explicitly turns into mindfulness with breathing, as soon as such a sign arises, shift your attention to this sign. This will be your object of attention as you proceed all along the rest of the nine stages leading to shamatha. At first, your sign will arise only sporadically. So when it disappears, return to the previous sensations of the breath. But eventually, it will appear more regularly and steadily. And from that point onward, focus your attention on this object. As you progress, so that's it. And then so in terms of the counterpart sign, he talks about this on page 157. He says, the Theravada tradition gives this specific description. So this, in terms of acquired sign or what's in Pali called nimitta, is described in a lot of more detail in the Theravada Buddhist traditions, particularly in the classic text, The Path of Purification from Buddha Gosa. Anyway, he says, the Theravada tradition gives this specific description of achieving shamatha by way of mindfulness of breathing. You begin this practice as described earlier by focusing on the tactile sensations of the breath, which are the sign for preliminary practice. Eventually, you shift your attention to the acquired sign of the breath, which becomes your meditative object until you achieve shamatha, at which point a third sign appears spontaneously. This is called the counterpart sign of the breath, which is a subtle emblematic representation of the whole quality of the air element. And so this is the stages that we go through if we're using the sensations of the breath as the object of shamatha practice. So let's turn our attention now to the meditation. First, we'll continue with the meditation that we did in the last session. So focusing on the area of the abdomen, focusing on the tactile sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. Again, maintaining continuity of mindfulness throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. And so here, even though we are enhancing stability of attention, we still have that balance, meaning that we still need to balance that with relaxation, not to increase stability of attention at the cost of losing relaxation. So as we mentioned in the last session, what you can do if you find it helpful is to do this balancing on each breath, because either we tend to be focused and tense or relaxed and dull. And so what we want to do is combine those two to be relaxed and focused and alert. So therefore, on the out-breath is a natural time to relax and release any tension. And the in-breath is a natural time to sharpen the focus. And also, if you find yourself getting distracted quite a lot in this meditation, and you find it helpful to improve stability of attention, you can bring in the counting or noting the breath. So let's do that practice again. We've done it a couple of times already. And this time we'll do, I'll do less guiding to give you more time to get into the practice too. Because every time I give some instruction, that's a little bit of a distraction for you. But of course, when we're learning the practice, we need these intermittent instructions to keep us on track. But now that you know this practice fairly well, then I'll do less guiding so you can get more into the practice. So if you'd like to find a nice comfortable posture, let's begin. We begin by setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. And setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Simply allowing it to come to rest in the present moment. Resting in stillness. And then from that stillness, bring your attention to the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. And maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. And monitoring that mindfulness with introspection, noticing if you're falling into dullness or distraction, and if so, adjusting accordingly, correcting, reapplying mindfulness. we can bring the meditation to a close. Let's now look at the process of actually achieving shamatha. So remember, shamatha is a particular level of concentration or samadhi that we're cultivating. In the previous two sessions, we looked at this classic nine-stage model of the stages we go through in terms of achieving shamatha. And we left off in the last session at stage nine. We see the picture here of the meditator with the elephant of the mind in the cave. And stage nine was called attentional balance. And what we achieved at this stage was flawless samadhi, sustained effortlessly. So we have completely flawless concentration, no tiny hint of subtle excitation, no tiny hint of subtle laxity, and we can sustain this effortlessly. It's completely spontaneous, and we can sustain this here at stage nine for at least 4 hours, no problems. And we do this through the power of familiarity, complete familiarity with this practice. Therefore, our mental engagement, the way in which we engage in this practice, is again effortless. It's spontaneous, no effort required at all. And the quality of our experience here is said to be one of perfection. And the analogy here was that the mind, of course, in an earlier stage has already become still, but now it's completely still, using the analogy of Mount Meru, the king of mountains, complete stillness of mind. And so therefore, as we saw earlier, particularly at these very high levels, it's very easy to misinterpret these experiences in terms of being a higher level, as we saw, but also in misinterpreting this sort of experiences as some sort of insight or realization of emptiness. And even here, we see another common misconception or misinterpretation here from, again, Tsongkhapa in his Lamrim Chenmo. He says, there are a great many people who specifically confuse this ninth mental stage with the culmination of the stage of completion in highest yoga tantra. So not only haven't we achieved shamatha here yet, we're nowhere near any sort of insight into emptiness, let alone that, but Tsongkhapa is saying at even the higher level of practice of tantra, we have generation stage and completion stage. And in completion stage, we are realizing emptiness, but we are also accessing the very subtle level of our mind, this mind of clear light. And Tsongkhapa is saying there are many people who confuse this with that. So it's very easy to confuse. And of course, if we do this, if we confuse ninth stage with that, we maybe get a bit delusional, thinking we're some high-level tantric practitioner and we're nearly enlightenment. In fact, here at stage nine, we haven't even entered the path yet. So it's important not to make these misinterpretations. That's why it's very important to have a qualified teacher who can really guide us closely and who can help avoid us make this misinterpreting these experiences. And then a quote from the Panchen Lama again, Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen, a 16th century Gelug master. In his shamatha part of his Mahamudra text, he says, no matter how stable such concentration may be, if it is not imbued with the bliss of physical and mental pliancy, it is merely a single-pointed mind of the desire realm, whereas concentration that is so imbued is said to be the mind of shamatha. So therefore, to go from this ninth stage to shamatha, we need to achieve this physical and mental pliancy. So let's have a look at the process of how that happens. And so here we'll quote from a sangha from the great Indian master from the 5th century in his, Shravaka Bhumi text, his Levels of the Hearer's text. He says, what is pliancy? It is a serviceability of the body and mind due to the cessation of the continuum of physical and mental dysfunctions, and it has the function of dispelling all obstructions. So now our body doesn't have pliancy, means we you sort of have a lot of this heaviness in the body, a lot of obstruction in the body in terms of body feeling heavy and so forth. And our mind has no pliancy now. And in terms of our mind has a lot, as we saw, we have a lot of resistance to this sort of practice. Whereas when we achieve pliancy, we have this flexibility and serviceability of body and mind. Physical pliancy is here. We see this diagram is actually achieving shamatha, and the meditator flying through the sky is symbolizing physical pliancy. It's said that when we achieve shamatha, our body feels light like cotton. And mental pliancy is symbolized by the meditator riding on the elephant of the mind. Meaning now, when we achieve shamatha, we can turn our mind to whatever we want without any resistance whatsoever. And Asanga goes on to say, at the very beginning, when you begin the correct training, the occurrence of mental and physical pliancy and serviceability is subtle and difficult to discern. So even at the early stages of shamatha, we start to have a little bit of pliancy of body and mind, but because it's so subtle, we don't notice it. But he says, just as your mental one-pointedness increases as you go through the stages, so does your physical and mental pliancy increase. These two phenomena, mental one-pointedness and pliancy, are based upon each other and are dependent upon each other. So as we move along these nine stages, we have greater and greater degrees of physical and mental pliancy. But let's see now what specifically happens going from stage nine to shamatha. So then in Asanga's text, he says, the portent of the proximate occurrence of mental and physical pliancy. So just before you achieve this pliancy, you have a sensation of heaviness on the top of your head. But this is not a harmful symptom. So we just notice some heaviness on the top of our head. And he says, as soon as this happens, mental dysfunction, which is included among the mental afflictions that obstruct delight in eliminating the afflictions, is itself eliminated. And mental serviceability and mental pliancy arise due to this antidote. So following that sense of heaviness, mental pliancy arises. And then he goes on to say, due to its occurrence, vital energies of the great elements that are conducive to arising of physical pliancy course throughout the body. So we have this movement of subtle energies in the body. And he says, because of their movement, one is freed of physical dysfunction affiliated with mental afflictions that obstruct delight in meditation. And it seems as if the entire body were filled with physical pliancy as the antidote for that. So again, physical pliancy, it's said that our body feels light like cotton. We have no heaviness or discomfort in the body anymore. And then what happens following that is due to the physical and mental pliancy, then we have the bliss of physical and mental pliancy arising. And so Asanga says the following, when this first arises, you experience a great sense of bliss and manifest joy. Following this, the force of pliancy that first arose slowly becomes very refined, and your body becomes endowed with shadow-like pliancy, a more subtle level of pliancy. The extraordinary mental joy is relinquished. The mind having a serene aspect becomes stabilized with shamatha with respect to the meditative object. So just to explain that a little bit more, we can read from Lamrim Chenmo from Tsongkhapa on this very point here. He says, now, physical pliancy is a very pleasant sensation within the body, not a mental process. He says, thus, when physical pliancy initially occurs, due to the power of energy, there arises a great sense of well-being in your body. And on this basis, there also arises in your mind a most exceptional experience of that pleasure. Thereafter, the force of this initial occurrence of pliancy gradually subsides. But this is not a case of pliancy becoming exhausted. Rather, this pliancy is coarse and excessively agitates your mind. So this bliss of physical mental pliancy is quite agitating the mind. But then he says, so with its disappearance, there occurs a pliancy tenuous like a shadow that is compatible with steady concentration. Once the rapturous delight of your mind has disappeared, your mind stabilizes firmly upon the object of meditation and you achieve shamatha, which is free of the turbulence caused by great delight. So now we have achieved shamatha. But then you may say, well, okay, so we've achieved shamatha, now what? Of course, this is within meditation. So you may ask, well, what happens when I come out of this meditation? So also here, what happens, or what is a side effect or residual effect or trait effect of achieving shamatha? Here we can quote from Tsongkhapa again, but from his middling lam rim. The lam rim chenma was his great lam rim, his extensive one. In his middling lam rim, he says the following. Moreover, in post-meditative experience, the occurrence of mental afflictions such as hatred is also utterly different than before, being feeble and incapable of being very prolonged. So what you notice, and you'll start to notice this even before you achieve shamatha, if you really make significant progress in shamatha practice, due to your improved attention skills, you will start to notice in daily life that your mental afflictions like craving, attachment, jealousy, hatred, anger, and so forth are not as strong as usual, and they tend to last for a shorter period of time. So you'll find that the effect of attention training, shamatha training, has this sort of capacity to temporarily subdue the mental afflictions. And then also Tsongkhapa says, of course, shamatha doesn't eliminate any mental afflictions. It can just sort of keep the lid on the mental afflictions mostly. But of course, it's not eliminating anything. To eliminate mental afflictions, we need to engage in vipassana practice. He also says, the sense of clarity is so great that you feel that you could count the atoms of the pillars and walls of your house. And due to deep attentional stability, sleep does not occur as it did prior to achieving samadhi. Samadhi just means concentration. Rather, you feel as if your sleep was suffused with samadhi and many pure dream appearances take place. He also says, for the most part, the five obscurations do not occur. And we'll look at the five obscurations shortly. And he says, when one arises from meditative equipoise, one still possesses some degree of physical and mental pliancy. So it's not like we only have physical mental pliancy in meditation. We still have a fair amount of physical and mental pliancy outside of meditation. Now, these five obscurations that Tsongkhapa mentions here, sometimes is translated as the five hindrances. And these five obscurations are what's obscuring samadhi, obscuring concentration. And they're listed here at the bottom. We see hedonic craving, malice, laxity and dullness, excitation, anxiety, afflictive uncertainty. So these five obscurations which obscure us from achieving samadhi, from achieving shamatha, are subdued. Again, we haven't eliminated them, but we can keep the lid on them. So a lot of our craving is subdued, our malice, laxity, dullness, excitation, anxiety, and afflictive uncertainty. They are mostly subdued due to achieving shamatha. But what about beyond shamatha? What do we do after shamatha? Of course, we can continue in the concentration or samadhi practice because there are many levels of samadhi above shamatha. So we went through the nine stages leading to shamatha. And those nine stages, of course, are within what's called the desire realm. That's the realm that we exist in now. But once we achieve shamatha, our mind actually has transcended what's called the desire, the realm we're in now, and it's entered into a more subtle level of existence called the form realm. And as we saw, when we achieve shamatha, we have freedom from these five obscurations temporarily, of course. We haven't eliminated them. But then we can go on to develop higher and higher levels of concentration of samadhi. And these four next levels, called the four jhanas, are very much emphasized in the Theravada Buddhist traditions, that they put a lot of emphasis into going on to cultivating first, second, and fourth level of jhana. And as we move up these higher levels, we have freedom from, we see here first, mental unhappiness, then even examination, investigation agitates the mind. We eliminate that at the second. At the third jhana, even the bliss we normally experience now is sort of unstabilizes the mind. We eliminate that. And even at the fourth jhana, we eliminate the happiness feeling. So we really only have the equanimity feeling left at the fourth jhana. And as said, in terms of a basis for Vipassana practice, the fourth jhana is the most stable and best basis for Vipassana practice. But of course, it takes a lot of effort to get there. The minimum level, as we're going to see in the next slide, to have an effective basis for Vipassana practice to gain a direct insight into reality is shamatha. And then even above the jhanas, we have four levels of samapatti, of absorptions, even much higher levels of concentration, where our mind enters a very subtle realm called the formless realm, where our mind becomes more and more subtle. In terms of Buddhist practice, these particularly samapattis are not very much use for Vipassana practice because the mind is too withdrawn, too absorbed. At the time of the Buddha, before the Buddha came along, a lot of the traditions at that time felt that this was the way to liberation, that by going through these higher and higher levels of samadhi, eventually we would exit samsara. But the Buddha found that we need to get out of samsara, we need the Vipassana. So these are higher levels of samadhi that we can focus, develop in samadhi or concentration practice. However, as we see here again, quoting Lamrim Chenmo, Tsongkhapa says, as I have explained, shamatha has the features of one, non-discursiveness, i.e., when your attention is intentionally set on a single object of meditation, it stays there. Two, clarity, it is free from laxity. And three, benefit in terms of delight and bliss. He says, however, you should not be satisfied with just this. So even though this brings up a lot of brings this shamatha brings us a lot of temporary benefits, he says, don't be satisfied with this. Rather, he says, developing the wisdom that properly determines the meaning of reality, you must cultivate insight. Otherwise, since mere concentration is something Buddhists have in common with even with non-Buddhists, its cultivation will not get rid of the seeds of the mental afflictions. Hence, it will not free you from samsara. So even though shamatha can really help us to temporarily subdue the mental afflictions, it will not eliminate any mental afflictions, and it will not eliminate suffering. For that, we need Vipassana. And that's what we see in the diagram, in that color diagram, the shamatha chart, right up the top. So we see here, again, in the middle at the top, shamatha. So we see the physical pliancy, the meditator flying through the sky, mental pliancy, the meditator riding on the elephant and mind. So this is shamatha. But then we have one more diagram right at the end of this shamatha path. And we see here the meditator on the elephant and the mind. In their right hand is a sword. This is a sword of wisdom. And we see some writing, two bits of writing here. And they say the following here. We see the root of samsara is cut by the union of shamatha and vipassana observing emptiness. So therefore, equipped with mindfulness introspection, seek the correct view of emptiness. So therefore, on the basis of shamatha, we can now effectively engage in Vipassana practice, particularly here in the Mahayana Buddhist traditions, this Vipassana practice, realizing emptiness. Because the Buddhist assertion is that it's our distorted view of reality that is the root cause of all of our mental afflictions and suffering. And particularly here in the Mahayana context, the root distorted view is grasping onto independent me, independent objective world. And so realizing emptiness is a realization there is no independent me, no independent objective world. Nothing exists independently. This is emptiness. But to directly realize this emptiness, we need a very stable, clear, focused mind. We need the mind of shamatha. Anything less than that, At best, we can have a taste of emptiness, but we won't be able to fully penetrate. We won't be able to have a direct realization of emptiness, which is what is required to eliminate mental afflictions and suffering and to go beyond samsara. One last point, and that is, and then we'll go to today's meditation, and that is, does this mean we first have to achieve shamatha fully before we can begin vipassana practice? No, it doesn't mean that. In fact, you will not achieve shamatha without doing some vipassana practice on the side, because our mental afflictions will start to create problems in the earlier stages. So adding some vipassana practice, even at the earlier stages of shamatha, can be helpful in terms of shamatha practice. But to eliminate mental afflictions and suffering, to go beyond samsara, we need a union of shamatha and vipassana. So that's beyond shamatha, what we are to do. Now, let's look at the actual practice for this evening session. So now we move our attention to the entrance of the nostrils. This is very much emphasized in many Buddhist traditions. And so when we say the entrance of the nostrils, we're talking about anywhere in this area here. So you can focus at the either at the actual entrance of the nostrils or this small area above the upper lip, whichever you find easier. So anywhere in this area here. And so, again, we are using bare attention to focus. So we're not visualizing the breath. We're not imagining the breath coming in, going down, coming out, and going out again. And we're not looking at the nose. Sometimes what happens is when we focus here, people start to look at the nose and make it a visual exercise. So we don't want to do that. It's not a visual exercise, and we'll be straining our eyes if we try and do that. Now, this variation of mindfulness of breathing is very conducive for cultivating clarity of attention, because we are bringing the attention up and it's a much smaller area of focus. So very conducive for improving clarity of attention. But again, here we need balance, meaning as we're improving clarity of attention, it's not at the cost of losing relaxation or stability. So we want to maintain the deep roots of relaxation, the strong trunk of stability, as we're working on improving in clarity of attention here. Now, as a beginner in this practice, there are often two main tendencies. One is that because it's usually a little bit more difficult to focus at the entrance of the nostrils, then we tend to bring our habit in from daily life. And that is to, whenever we focus, we tense. So when something's difficult to focus on in daily life, we tense. And so what we tend to do in this practice, because it's more difficult to focus, we tense. So we want to make sure that we keep that relaxation. So with the introspection, particularly in this practice, monitor the area of the face. Notice any tightness and tension in the face, particularly around the eyes, across the forehead. Any tightness or tension, relax, 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 particularly on the out-breath. And another tendency can be is if we don't really notice any sensations here, sometimes people breathe more forcefully to pick up the sensation. So we don't want to do that either. So just let the breathing flow naturally and just pay closer attention here without tightening or tensing. So just be mindful of those two things. Breath flowing naturally and stay relaxed in the body and the mind. And as with the earlier practice of mindfulness of breathing, if you find in this practice you're getting distracted a lot and you find it helpful, you can bring in some counting or noting of the breath to help stabilize the attention. So that's the practice we're going to do now. Mindfulness of breathing, focusing at entrance to the nostrils, working on improving clarity of attention, maintaining the basis of stability and relaxation. So let's do that practice now. So finding a nice comfortable posture, let's begin. Keeping the back nice and straight. And at the same time, allow the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And allowing the mind to come to rest in the stillness of the present moment. Allowing the mind to become relaxed, still, and clear. Now, whilst maintaining that relaxed body and relaxed mind, bring your attention to the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils. So either focusing at the actual entrance of the nostrils or the small area above the upper lip, whichever you might find more easy. And simply notice the sensations as the breath flows across this area. keeping all the muscles in the face soft and relaxed. The breathing flowing naturally, not trying to force or regulate the breath in any way. Thank you. And we can bring the meditation to a close. It's time for some question answer. So any questions there, Miffy?
Well, I'll give people a chance to write one, but I have one for you, Glenn.
Sure.
With the first meditation, I'm not sure if I missed a instruction with the breath on the abdomen, because like trying to get out from the sensation of being behind my eyes to just focusing on the sensation of the breath there. But there's a whole lot of movement. So do you focus on the abdomen, like you're trying to be in the abdomen, or the, you know, the breath coming in and going out, there's all this movement happening? Or do you like broaden your awareness to focus on the whole body with the abdomen in it?
So the first variation, the full body, was what you were explaining there, is to particularly to establish relaxation, it's very good just to notice sensations anywhere in the body connected with the whole process of breathing. So then you can notice the moving of the abdomen, the chest, the stomach, something in the throat, the nostrils, anything. That was the first practice. The abdomen is now we're narrowing down the focus to only focus on the area of the abdomen, to focus, and again, with all of these shamatha practice, use bare attention, meaning we're focusing directly on the actual tactile sensations. So we're not so sort of like visualizing something or imagining the abdomen moving or anything. We're not visualizing the breath coming in, going down, coming up, going out. That's you can do that in other practices, but here in the abdomen practice, we're focusing on the actual tactile sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. Anything outside of that is a distraction. And so just to let that go and come back to that. And the nostrils, of course, we're narrowing down even further, just focusing on this little area here. Again, bare attention, the actual tactile sensations.
Okay, thank you. Rachel has a question. Can practicing meditation make us more sensitive, especially as beginners, like kind of more emotional or getting affected by others' emotions?
The main tool we're using in this practice is mindfulness. So in this practice, we are cultivating, we are strengthening our mindfulness, which means that we will become more aware of things in general. And that's a good thing, because not being aware of things causes a lot of problems in our life. But again, this practice comes in a package within Buddhist context. So this is really the basis of the other two main wings of practice of wisdom and compassion. And that is where we do a lot of the work in terms of how to deal with our mental afflictions and developing positive qualities and so forth. So if we are not doing any of that, meaning we're only doing some sort of shamatha practice, some mindfulness practice, and unfortunately in some of the modern day mindfulness traditions, that's basically all they give you is mindfulness to improve that, which is good. That's the basis of everything else. But if that's all we're doing, then of course we'll become more aware of everything, and we'll become more aware of our mental afflictions and all that sort of things. But then we won't have any tools to do anything with that, because we won't know what to do. So it's possible that if you are doing a imbalanced practice, meaning only doing sort of shamatha practice, you may find that you become more sensitive. But the answer to that is not to become less sensitive, to block that. I mean, that's what we do now, is when these things come up, we're sensitive to these things and we don't know how to deal with it and it overwhelms us. What do? We block it. We suppress it. We numb it with alcohol and drugs and so forth. We're not sensitive. So we're oscillating between these two extremes, and those two extremes are just harming us, whether we're sensitive and reacting or whether we're knocked out on the head by suppressing. So what we're doing in the bigger picture here is the middle way. And in the middle way, the first thing, of course, is we need to become aware of all these things going on. Otherwise, we can't do anything with them. But then in addition to that, we need to have these tools then to do something with that when mental afflictions arise. But one thing actually in the shamatha practice of observing the mind, one tool of how to deal with this stuff is just to be able to watch it, to observe it. And so that's one of the benefits of, here we're using the breath, but particularly if we use the mind as the object of shamatha practice, which includes, of course, observing thoughts, emotions, memories, and so forth. One of the things, side benefits of that shamatha practice is that we will develop the ability to not get caught up in these things that appear in our mind, our thoughts and emotions and so forth, to be able to watch them. So that will give us some ability to be present with this stimulus and not be sensitive. But to really be effective in that, we need to even add to that, we need to add some vipassana, because the sensitive, the reacting is coming from grasping, which we need to eliminate there. And then we also need to work on loving kindness and compassion. So the bottom line is that if we have a balanced practice, then this can only help us in our life.
Okay, that's very helpful. Then there's a couple of related questions. One from Andrew, are there other places that we can focus on, like the heart, for example? And Deepa's got a related question of, does it matter where the awareness seems to be placed, because she feels most relaxed when her awareness sinks into the abdomen.
Sure.
But when generating compassion, it seems to be more placed at the heart.
In terms of shamatha, remember we're doing single pointed concentration. So we're picking a object and focusing. And of course, when we go down, naturally more relaxed. I mean, just even now, if you bring your attention up, you become more alert. You bring it down, you become more relaxed. So abdomen is good for relaxation, same as full body. Full body, you're bringing really the attention down. What's not very much recommended in shamatha practice is to focus at the heart as a point. Because the heart, and by heart, I don't mean the physical heart, I mean the center of the chest. From a Buddhist perspective, when we go particularly into Tantra, this is what's there is the heart chakra. And this is a very powerful, energetic point. And so if we put all our attention there, and we do that not in a very balanced way, we do that with tension and we're pushing, and we put the attention there, we can really completely unbalance subtle energies in the body, and that completely unbalances the mind. So these points along the center of the body, focusing in the center of the chest, focusing here, for example, between the eyes and so forth, these are very powerful points, and I wouldn't recommend dabbling in shamatha focusing in these points. You are likely to come unstuck. I wouldn't recommend it unless you have a highly qualified teacher and they're guiding you closely, then you could, but certainly it's not recommended to do that, because that's where we focus in Tantra. But by the time we get to Tantra, we have some basis and we can effectively work with those powerful energetic points in the body. But at the beginning level, I wouldn't recommend it.
Okay, and then Richard asks, with the focus on the nostrils, it seems to generate an extra awareness of the flow of air, which feels almost like hyperventilating. Any comments, please?
So again, particularly here, as I mentioned, the tendency can be to control the breath, particularly if we're not picking up much. People tend to force the breath a bit so they can pick up sensations. So if you notice that, just let that go, let it go, let it go. Just let the breathing flow naturally. And yes, because it's a small area and clarity improves, if you've not done this practice before and you really start to get into it, you're going to notice all sorts of things you've probably never noticed in your life before. because we're sort of caught up in dullness. So you'll know, I mean, if you really start to focus here very intently, you can even sort of pick up movement of moisture on individual hair follicles. And it can even feel like there's a heap of moisture here because you're picking that up. And then, but then if you touch it, you'll go, oh, there's no real moisture there. But you're picking up so refined sensations here. And it's like, if you've never done it before, it's hard to believe that you can notice that. But that's a sign that clarity is improving. And so that's good. And that's one of the benefits with this. And I'll be talking a little bit more about this focusing at the nostrils in the next session in terms of what's called a biofeedback loop. But we'll leave that till the next session.
Then there's just a couple more. So one, again, from Andrew about how you mentioned eventually you'll see that symbol for the
quiet sign. Yeah.
The sign. So can you speed up the process by visualizing the sign, i.e. fake it till you make it?
No, the acquired sign is not something you generate. The acquired sign is something that spontaneously arises and it's relating to the air element coming into balance. So it's not something you can generate.
Okay. And then Ian asks, with Vipassana, it's recommended to get advice and instruction from a teacher. And is there a significance in Vipassana retreats that they seem to be over 10 days? Could you do shorter ones, for instance?
Yeah. Well, I won't comment on that, actually. And he's probably most likely referring to the Goenka 10-day Vipassana retreat, because that's quite widely known. But actually, technically, it's misleading. It's not a 10-day Vipassana retreat, because for anyone who's done that, for the first 4 days, you focus here. You're doing what's called anapanasati. You're doing mindfulness of breathing. So actually for the first 3 or 4 days, you're doing no Vipassana. You're only doing shamatha, because as we saw just now in this slide, shamatha is the basis of Vipassana. So that's why you spend 3 or 4 days doing only shamatha, 10 hours a day, in the hope that after 3 or 4 days, you've developed some stability and clarity of attention, then you can enter into Vipassana practice. But why it's 10 days, just a number, I guess they picked up. So there's no significance, I think, to that. Perhaps the original thinking with Goenka was that, you know, doing another, then 6 days of Vipassana was you needed to do maybe 5 or 6 days to have some experience or something. I don't know why 10, but certainly in the beginning, I wouldn't recommend too long. If you're doing a solitary retreat, then do it very, very short, just 1 or 2 days. It's good to start with group retreats first. Once you've done some experience with those, then you can start with solitary, but I certainly wouldn't start on a 10-day solitary retreat doing shamatha vipassana or doing any 10-day retreat on your own. It's a little bit too much. Start small and work up.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you.
Any last question or that's it?
That's it. Yep.
Okay. Good. Great. So again, let's just sit quietly for a moment and dedicate all of our efforts in this evening session. So again, based on the initial motivation that you set at the start. And so then the next session, of course, will be on Tuesday, session 7. We'll continue the mindfulness of breathing at the nostrils practice. So a little bit more comments about that practice. And we're also going to be looking at these prerequisites for shamatha practice, shamatha training, how to set up our life in such a way to effectively support shamatha practice. So that's going to be the main topic for Tuesday. So that's all for this session. So until Tuesday, stay safe, stay well, have a nice weekend. We'll see you on Tuesday evening. Thank you.